So the next few Wednesday nights, then three, at least, there's early only four Wednesday nights left, which is crazy to think. Thank you so much. Because we have next week, and then we have Halloween, and then we have another week, and then one more week, and then Thanksgiving, and then like the last Wednesday night. So how's that for crazy? That's fast. So three of the next few Wednesday nights, I'm going to take at least part of the time and teach through each of those three Wednesday nights our three pillars: discipleship, devotion, and hospitality. And part of that's because we're going to have the what's that? Jump in case I couldn't remember. And part of that will be because we want those for the website, and so to have that training available for the website, and so we want to. We're going to have some people here videoing that part of the talk in particular. Please come to that and make sure we're as part of that conversation. And then however long I need to teach that, I will teach that. And then when I'm done with that, we will then go to Q&A on those nights as well. Anyway, I think that's all I need. What kind of announcement? Do we have any other announcements we need to? So Wednesday night on Halloween night, on the 31st, you're welcome to. We will have a chili cook-off. If you're someone who would like to compete for that, we will have prizes and stuff. Kids can come in costumes, all that kind of stuff. What's that? Yeah. You have that yet? We can do this first, but don't if you want to come as a family and have chili and then, you know, leave and go trick or treat or something like that, you're welcome to do that. The night is not like programmed out or anything. We are here to hang out, to relax, to enjoy each other, to play games or whatever until 7. We will kick everybody out at 7. But if you want to come and have chili and then you want to go to Flint Baptist, where they're going to have this, I'm sure, massive fall festival that night, don't hesitate to do that. You're not going to hurt anybody's feelings if you want to come here and eat, or just, I mean, even if you miss eating and just go there, that's totally fine. We're not in competition with other churches, but yes. Is there youth that night? Yeah, they're going to come join us in here. So to hang out or whatever. So just feel free to take care of that however you want to. And if anybody's interested, in a second we do Q&A, if what you want to talk about, in case this is a thing that still troubles people, if Halloween is a topic that troubles you, we can happily talk about that if anybody needs to. That'd be fine. And then we do have a work day, a budget votes next. So next Wednesday, and then not the next one, but the next one, Wednesday at about 5-ish, you can come if you have questions about the budget. We will happily talk to you about questions about the budget. I was just doing the finance team spear blocking contest that you do, where they ask all the great questions. We'll meet in here, up here at the front of the room, and if you have any questions, we will get budgets to you. I presume Sunday we will have them available in here in the room if you want to get them. I don't think there's anything that would be like shocking or weird or anything, but just so you know that you'll have availability of that and ask questions. And then we have Thanksgiving bags. This is a way we partner with First Baptist Church, that they do a big food giveaway on, I guess it's November probably 20th-ish, that weekend usually. Probably the Saturday before Thanksgiving is normally when they do it. And so if you want to get one of those bags, fill it as it says, and then get it back here, or even if you want to take it straight downtown, that's even better, but because we'll just deliver it to downtown to First Baptist. We still partner with them in regards to getting food to needy people downtown. Israel? Yes, I forgot we get to announce Israel now. So 2019... we will be, Lord willing, going to Israel June 10th through 21st. So we will be arriving in Dallas on the morning of the 21st, we will go for 9 days on the ground and then the 2 days travel on both ends. It looks like the cost is going to be right at $39.50 a person. That covers, it's actually cheaper than. Deborah Harder and I have found multiple ways throughout the year. She's done so many of these. She's found ways to make them quite a bit cheaper. it's obviously not cheap. That's still expensive. I mean, even though it's cheap for what you're getting, it's still a lot of money, obviously. And so that's something that we would love to encourage people to do for those 10 days. It's a wonderful time. You do have to have at least the capacity to walk over uneven ground pretty much off and on all day. The days that we're in the Jerusalem proper, in the old city, for example, is a lot of walking. It's broken up. And so if you could walk 3 miles, just if you could sit down and just walk 3 miles, you'll probably be fine. We don't do a lot of otherwise, anything more than that. So you could start now if you want to go and you're like, I don't think I could walk 3 straight miles. Well, you could start now, and by next June, you'll be fine. I think it is fair to say it is a life-changing experience to get to go. So I certainly think so. Any others? Am I saying anything I need to about Israel? Any other questions about Israel? We only take 30 people. So it's a small trip, so that's much more close, and we can sit and sing together and discuss things and that kind of stuff. It's just more fun to go with a smaller crowd, in my opinion. I mean, it's great to go anyway, but that's just fun to me. And we do the little headphones. So one of the games is catch Chris forgetting that his mic is on. Like, that's one of the fun games we play when we're on Israel, is when Chris starts talking about something that everyone can hear without knowing that everyone can hear it. So imagine that does not work out well for me. Yes. Every other year is the plan. So we try to do every other year. If there were enough interest, we would probably go every year. But it's obviously a lot of work to put it on and to get it going. And it's the travel is not easy on everybody. You leave at 10 o'clock in the morning and you land at 10 o'clock in the morning. From place to place is essentially a full day. Now, about 12 hours of that is in the air. 12 to 14 hours of that is actually in the air the whole time. But it is a lot. So you catch a lot of movies.
What other expenses?
Thank you. There are essentially no other expenses. There are a few lunches that you may have to cover for yourself, which is between 10 and 20 bucks. And then souvenirs. Everything else is covered. Breakfast, dinners, about half the lunches, every entry point, every bribe, everything. Yeah, I'm not. Notice I'm not laughing. So there are places you get to, things you get to do because there's a special fee that you pay to the person who has the key to that gate. So it's the gate opening fee.
When does the money have to be?
First 500 is due January 1st. And then it's paid throughout up until about the month before. It was when the last bit's due. But you can reserve a place by paying 500 on January 1st. And as long as you keep it updated, you'll have a place reserved. Great question. Let me tell you the full reason why I love going is I love the experience of watching you guys, who I love, experiencing it. Like, it is so fun to watch you experience it. It's just one of my highlights of my life to get to watch that happen. So it's worthwhile. Any others? When is the work? Do you know when the work day is that we're planning? November 3rd. Plans for a work day. It won't be a work day like, hey, show up and we'll just whatever. There will be tasks like to sign up for and be a part of to help fix or do or work on or whatever. So anyway, we will be much more clear about that. We'll let you know more details, but you can mark off November 3rd, at least the first half of that day if you're. Thank you. Good stuff. Okay. All right, good. So what are we going to talk about tonight? You get to decide. Oh, yes. Hi, Anel.
Yeah, I just can't get enough of you, I guess. What are your thoughts about Halloween? I'd like
to. Okay, we'll do that. Anel said she can't get enough of me. She's in a 2-hour theology class with me on Wednesday mornings. And yeah, those are intense. I think she goes home every day. She tells Don, like, I have a headache today, and it's Chris's fault. So, Let me give you the quick, this is kind of a fascinating thing to me. I think this is, Halloween is an interesting one to me. And I have a lot of detail and multiple articles on my website about this that will fill in a lot of these gaps. If you go to chrismlegg.com and type in Halloween, it'll give you a lot. But so it's one of the things that's been intriguing to me that I have this advantage by being raised by a Christian who is also an environmental scientist. And so I've always gotten to hear his comments when Christians react weirdly to things. And we have this nasty habit of doing that. We react before we think. Very often in Christianity is we have knee-jerk kind of flare-up weird reactions to things, and we don't go through it. So one of my favorites right now is the fact that for example, you will see probably not a single church in Tyler host a Halloween event, right? It'll be a fall festival. So fall festival is a pretty loose translation of the pagan name of this time of the year. Halloween is the Christian name for this time of the year, All Hallowed's Day Eve. November 1st is All Holy Day, and the day before All Holy Day is All Holy Day Eve. So All Hallowed Day's Eve is where we get the word Halloween. Halloween is the Christian name. Fall Festival is the pagan name. But in our effort to not sound pagan, because Halloween is obviously evil, 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 so we change it and end up kind of stabbing ourselves in the back in a weird way with this. It's really, and Christian, we do this constantly. It's amazing how and we have this a long, proud, although it should be humble, legacy of reacting foolishly to things that I don't even know how far back to take it. I mean, all the way back. And I guess everyone does it. It's human nature. But and it sometimes really takes us out of the conversation. For example, I really hate that when years ago when the Harry Potter books came out. And as a psychologist who works with children, I thought, and there's some pretty deep psychological issues that the Harry Potter books bring to the table. I mean, the good guys are the ones who break the rules, and the bad guys are the ones who want the rules maintained. That seems like an important psych. Snape is a bad guy. What makes Snape a bad guy? You ever think about it? If you've read the books, what makes Snape a bad guy is he wants the kids to follow the rules, to not be out of bed at night, to not steal from other people, and to not cheat. And that's what makes him a bad guy. Dumbledore's a good guy because he always lets the kids get away with this bad behavior that they do, and he kind of covers for them. To me, that's a significant issue for a book that all of the children are reading. Like, we ought to deal with, as parents, we need to engage in that conversation. But the minute someone found out I was a Christian, they didn't want to know what my opinion was on Harry Potter because they knew what it was. It's evil because there are witches in it. Even though I've said for years, like, if you join the Wicca movement because you read Harry Potter, you're in for a huge disappointment, right? I mean, you're going to be very disappointed when you go to your first coven meeting and they're not doing any of that stuff. It's nothing like Hogwarts. So you're going to be really disappointed. I thought, like, this is going to disillusion people from the pagan world, not encourage it. I don't think anybody said, like, I'm going to become a witch because of these books. And then something like The Onion or Babylon Bee would publish an article making fun of the way Christians respond to something, and Christians would then copy and paste that on their website as somehow evidence for something. You're like, you don't know that these are like sarcastic web pages. Like, they're intentionally making fun of you, and you just posted it as though it was real news. That means they're making fun of you. It's you who they had in mind, apparently, if you can't tell the difference. And so Christians do this kind of stuff all the time. Halloween is one of these weird ones that we've responded to strangely, I think. And I grew up in the perfect era for this. I mean, we during the late 70s into the early 80s, my family didn't do Halloween because Christians don't, we don't do things like that. We don't. Now, when I was four, we have pictures of me at four, no, five, with my newborn little sister dressed as an angel and me dressed as a devil. I mean, horns, tail. That was when my parents started going to church again. It was like the full cape, the full horns. It was impressive. So here's, just so you will know, I won't go into a whole lot of detail here, but this is really fascinating. And this is one of the theories for how this happened. And I think this is probably accurate. But so the real quick answer to some of this is you have the when you're in a pagan world, in a prehistory world, the way you tell one day from another is how long it's daylight and how long it's dark. That's how you tell the difference. And you get the darkest day of the year somewhere around December 21st, and you get the longest light day of the year sometime in the middle of the summer, around the middle of July. And that's how they told time. That's how they knew the year was the darkest days and the lightest days, that and the phases of the moon, those were which we talked about in the Jewish world, is what they used. And then you have halfway points between those. So you have the summer solstice and the winter solstice, right? And then you have the halfway points in between them. So they put pagan festivals on those 4 days because it's easy to count those, to know those days. Well, so if you start going like, what do you want to celebrate on these days? So at the spring solstice, of course, you're going to celebrate new life. And you have to be dumb not to notice. The world is coming back to life. There is green suddenly, and the rabbits are suddenly having lots of babies, and the fruit trees are producing fruit. And what you're mainly doing at the springtime is you're celebrating the fact that you survived winter. Because remember, until modern history, most people didn't. I mean, in Jamestown, they had to repopulate from England every year because the majority of people just died. So imagine, if you will, in the fall, about this time of the year, it's about to get ugly. I mean, if you live in New England or you live in Europe about this time of the year, it's about to get bad. And the only source of fire you have is wood, and there's not much of that in Europe. And so you've got a real problem on your hands, and chances are someone's going to die in your family over the next 6 months or so, four to six months. At least someone is. One or two of your kids are. At least one of the spouses probably is. I mean, this is going to happen. You know it. You're going to get, somebody's going to get sick. They're going to get cold. You're going to run out of food. So you can imagine what happens is, if you're a pagan culture, you're looking to, the winter is about to be nightmarishly bad. So what you want to do is you want to make sure that the bad things that could happen to you are not being encouraged by whatever god or gods or spirits or whatever that you worship. So right about now is you're hunkering down, and but you're also celebrating the harvest. You just brought in harvest, right? And so that harvest has now told you how many of you are going to die this winter. It gives you a pretty good number of, like, are we going to be able to starve? Are we going to starve or not? Do we get enough grain, wheat, barley, whatever, to live? Or animals before. And so they're counting all that up. They're celebrating. They have a fall festival, but it's to celebrate the end of the harvest. And yet at the same time, the end of the harvest is also a way of saying the start of dying. And so they do that. Well, at the darkest day of the year, everyone has been huddled up in their homes for the last 2 months. And the darkest day of the year, you light your log that's going to last all night, your Yule log that's going to last all night. And so that's what you're going to do. You're going to celebrate that. And you all come out and you have a party together. And the main thing you're doing when you're coming together, and this is actually probably pragmatically how it happened, is you're seeing who's still alive. And so if I had enough, so I've got a family of seven. So I had enough food for seven. And it's just the end of December. It's December 21st, 22nd. I come out and let the community know 3 of them died. So I was a family of seven. I'm now a family of 4. But I have enough food for a family of 7. Are any of you short on food? Because I have extra. And so you would exchange and trade gifts of what you have that I ran out of and what I have that you ran out of. And because you've got another 2.5 months to go at least. So that's what's done in the middle. Then at the end, when things start getting green again and you start getting fruit again and that kind of stuff and animals again reproducing, it's a big celebration. So this is how the summer, you're too busy. You're too busy harvesting and you're too busy planting and you're too busy tending to have much of a celebration in the middle of the summer. So that was the pagan year, was measured that way. Well, when the Roman Catholic Church, and even predates the Roman Catholic Church, when the church showed up, but especially once the Roman Catholics showed up, it's not like they have some much better way to measure time. So what they do is they place a Christian holiday on top of the pagan holidays, which makes total sense. It's like us taking a secular song and giving it Christian lyrics, right? So that's what they did. So they just took it over and they just threw a bigger party. And so they would throw a bigger, better party at this time of the year. There is no way Jesus was born at the end of December. No way. It is not. It is just completely almost impossible. Of all the dates possible for Jesus to have been born, that one is almost certainly, I mean, at the bottom 10. Almost no way he was born at that time of the year. And yet so why do we celebrate that? Well, what else are we going to, when are we going to celebrate that? Easter's obvious. Easter's in the spring because it actually happened in the spring. It happened at Passover. So we know when Easter happened. So we celebrate the resurrection of Jesus in the spring, which also fits nicely with the whole rebirth concept and all that kind of stuff. But it actually happened then. So we know that one. We have no idea when Jesus was born. So what's the next big pagan festival? Well, it's the middle of the winter festival. So let's throw our biggest, next biggest holiday there. And let's compete the pagans out of business. Now, of course, what happened was the pagans, the poor illiterate peasants who were, they just go to both parties. They weren't dumb. They just went to both. And so they began to combine over the years, combine them. So much of our Christmas celebration involves things that have pagan heritage to them. And so whether it's the redistribution of wealth, so to speak, of gift giving and stuff like that, which has a very pragmatic side of it, or whether it's the Christmas tree, which has to do with the celebration, continued celebration of the life of the, hey, we made it this far, the evergreen nature, which was in Europe at least worshipped by Druids and others, or at least referenced in Druid worship. So things like that. So it's fascinating. Christmas, some of our Christmas celebrations are based on that. And so the next one was the big All Saints Day, Holy Day, the day of All Saints when we celebrate all the saints, November 1st. Let's put that at the equinox, halfway between the summer and winter solstices, at the equinox, which is when they do their big fall festival, which makes sense. It's a good time to do it. The harvest has come in. Let's have a big fall festival. And the church just came in and said, perfect, well, we will do that. We'll just do it on November 1st, and we'll celebrate all the saints, and we'll compete your fall festival out because we can do it better, which, by the way, is precisely what you see in East Texas, right? I mean, I don't know how many witches' covens there are in East Texas, but I bet they're greatly overshadowed by all the churches putting on trunk and treats, right? I mean, like, we blow them out of the water. There's no competition with you. You can't compete with the church once we decide we're going to do it well. And so that's what was happening. So, of course, we just continue to celebrate those. But here's what boggles my mind, is that when you have people in the Christian world who say, well, so because spruce trees were part of pagan worship, we shouldn't have spruce trees in our house at Christmas. As if some druid created the first spruce tree. You understand that spruce tree, they don't get to own that. Druids don't get to own spruce trees. Our theology is that God created spruce trees and black cats and pumpkins and bats and Yule logs. And all of those were created by God. And so what matters about celebrating something is what you mean when you celebrate it. And so, yeah, you can abuse Scripture. If you celebrate Scripture in an abusive way, that's evil. But if you celebrate a Christmas tree in a Christ-honoring way, well, it's his tree. This is the, I say before, like I put this in the article, is I feel like I grew up with a sense of, you know, this is the day the Lord has made, let us rejoice and be glad in it, unless it's December 31st. I mean, October 31st, in which case we need to hunker down and load our guns. And that, I mean, like, because this is the devil's day. Somehow he gets a day. And I never, like, I don't think we get, now, I understand the philosophy of saying Christians need to stand out. But I don't think Christians stand out best by backing off. I think we stand out best by jumping in. And so, yeah, do we celebrate the same way? I would never dress my kids up in something that has a pagan edge to it. Not intentionally, but I wouldn't do that because I wouldn't want to miscommunicate that. I don't know that that's somehow evil. I don't think a kid is any more likely to be evil because they dressed up as a witch when they were four or not. Because one, that's not what witches look like, except in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. That's not witches. That's not the issue with witches. Like, I think of course we can abuse and twist and pervert anything as humans. But to think that Satan gets to own certain things, I think is error. Say that Satan gets to own certain days, I think is error. He doesn't get to own any of it. He didn't create any of it. He can only pervert what God has created. So I'm a huge fan. One, I think it's ironic that we have so fled the word Halloween that me even saying it in church and referencing that we're going to do something as a church on Halloween, there are a lot of people who can't tolerate that language. I totally understand if you say, listen, our family, we don't celebrate Halloween. Well, that's fine. That's your family can decide to do that. There's no issue with that. But I don't think that should be because somehow it is theologically the devil's day. You need to recognize if you don't want to celebrate Halloween because you think that's a way for your family to stand out in a positive way, that's fine. But if you're saying we're not celebrating Halloween because that's going to make us more evil, I think that's probably not a healthy way to engage with that. So I'm a much bigger fan of the way we've done it, which is a lot of times a lot of churches to say like, yeah, we own this. This is our day. Yes, sir.
I've never seen any denomination celebrate November 1st being All Saints Day. Is that still a thing?
Sure. In the more liturgical churches, Lutheran churches, Episcopalian churches, Roman Catholic churches, and Orthodox churches, they very much so still celebrate that. And then in the homeschool world, of course, kids dress up as saints because they can't dress up as witches. So they, same costume, just without the hat. It's a, it's been fun because and I've engaged in churches. I've worked in 7 different churches. And so they've been churches with very different attitudes about this, you can imagine. And there are churches who, the irony of going, this church is totally fine with my kid having a Star Wars birthday party and my kid's dressing up as Star Wars characters. But if they dress up as a Star Wars character on Halloween, that's bad. Because Star Wars is connected to paganism and all, I mean it is. But it's connected to paganism and all that kind of stuff. Like, that's somehow evil. Like, it's an intriguing distinction. And in our therapy office, so don't tell anybody I told you this, but in the therapy office, we describe Halloween as a time for all the ladies to show their daddy issues. So there's way too much of that goes on Halloween for sure. It's like, yeah, we can tell whose dads is involved, whose dads are involved in their lives and not based on how the young ladies dress on Halloween. So anyway, I'm a big fan of it. I think it's good that we do a kind of a family celebration. Let me tell you why we don't do some big, huge trunk or treat type of event. It's because almost every other church in Tyler does. And there's no reason for us to recreate that. Flint Baptist that is their fireworks event. Southside Baptist Church, that is their fireworks event. They spend a big portion of their budget. It is a huge event that many, many people in their church are involved in. I highly recommend taking your kids to one of those. Those are great ones. Colonial Hills used to have the best one in town. They've kind of, some years they do it now, and some years they don't. When they've done it, it used to be, I mean, that was where our family went for sure. It was such a great, Robert Carter threw the best party in town on Halloween for a long time. I'm a huge fan of that. There's no reason for us to recreate that. And so go to one of those churches that does that and have a great time and use their budget money rather than ours. I think it's a great idea. It's a great thing to involve parents and grandparents and family members in. Just don't worship Satan. That's my recommendation on Halloween. Don't worship Satan that night at all. Not even a little bit. Anyway, but it is fascinating. There's much more detail on my website if you want to study that with how this plays out. But it was fun to me to learn it, so it's fun to pass on. Okay, what else? Yes, ma'am.
Sort of along the same.
Yeah.
Thing, is that about yoga?
About yoga. Fascinating conversation. Okay, so again, growing up, somewhere around 6th grade is when I started taking a martial art called Hapkido, which is a Korean-based martial art that's founded in Taoism. Taoism is an Eastern philosophy. It's some people call it religion. It's really not a religion. It's a philosophy. It has religious implications, but it's kind of like Confucianism. It's really not a religion. It's a philosophy. So what it required me to do as a young man, as a Christian very early on, was to filter what can I accept and what can I not accept from this teaching. And so the martial arts aspect of it, the ability to fight and to know how the body worked and the discipline and all that kind of stuff, none of that seemed like a problem to me. And when the instructor was as atheist as he could, I mean, probably self-absorbed, probably worshipped himself, but as he could possibly be. But it was, he didn't spend a lot of time on the religious aspects of this martial art, even though the symbol that we had, one of the symbols involved the yin-yang Taoist symbol, which teaches that the universe is in balance between evil and good, male and female, dark and white, and all that kind of stuff, which is nonsense and is totally illogical. But that falls apart with a lot of different ways. But I was able to test everything, to quote from the Apostle Paul, and keep that which was good. And that's how I think we have to do with stuff like that. Yoga comes from a Hindu discipline. So in Hinduism, there's multiple different paths to God. Now, I'm going to tell you up front, when you teach on Hinduism, it's really hard because Hinduism makes no claim on rationality. Multiple beliefs within Hinduism contradict each other. like radically contradict each other, and that's not a problem for Hinduism. They make no claim on it being rational or logical in any way. Yes, they contradict each other, and that's fine. That's just, you just have to deal with it. But one of the teachings in yoga, in Hinduism is that there's a lot of different paths towards divinity, towards becoming more divine, which again is contrary, but they teach that we all already are just part of the imagination of Brahma. Brahma is kind of the God-ish thing that all existence is really about. And so I always thought it, I mean, again, for me, it was weird to go, so I'm already just an expression of the imagination of Brahma, and so I need to do these things to become more like God? I thought I already was an expression of his imagination. Like, oh, aren't I already? So none of that makes any sense, but it doesn't. So one of them is asceticism, means to control the body. And so through fasting, through sitting in the lotus position, through laying down on a bed of nails, through, you know, dealing with cobras, all those different things are an expression of one of the different paths towards getting close to God. So these are all religious books. And the yoga is an expression of getting closer to God, in Hindu teaching, getting closer to God through body control. That's the idea, okay? I would recommend, if you're going to take a yoga class, that you don't go to one that teaches that. That you wouldn't go to a yoga class that teaches, hey, by doing these stretches and these positions and this kind of stuff, you are getting nearer to God, because that's dumb as well as wrong. It's just, that's not going to, that doesn't work that way, right? You like my yoga pose? Hand in the pocket, pastor position. But the fact that you can become a stretchier person by doing yoga, if it calms your body down or whatever, there's nothing erroneous about that. I've never understood why that would somehow be bad to involve yourself in just because of that. Now, you want to be aware. You don't want to be ignorant when you go in and not understand. There can be Hindu roots to that. It'd be nice to know that, especially in case somebody begins to teach that. But for the Christian, we get to claim all the things that God has given us, so long as they don't lead us into sin and they don't lead us towards that. So is that something that could be perverted and you've got to be careful with? Of course it is. So whether you're talking Harry Potter or Halloween or yoga, it's the same principle is going, what of this is appropriate for a Christian to engage with and what isn't? And there's going to be aspects of any of it probably that aren't. That's my opinion. Yes, ma'am. So mindfulness is a fascinating trend that's going on that, again, depends on what you're doing with it. Mindfulness as just a psychological being in the moment that you're in, being aware, is remarkably similar to the idea of being still, which is a Christian discipline and a biblical discipline, is learning to be still. We don't meditate on nothing. Like in the Eastern religions, they often meditate on nothing. They empty your mind, which is just another way of saying don't think or be stupid or whatever, which is not a Christian principle. But meditation certainly is a Christian principle to focus on, to meditate on, but what we meditate on is truth. And we need to do that. A lot of times when we feel doubt or anxiety or fear or whatever, we need to be reminded of certain truths, and we need to meditate on that truth, on the truth of who God is, on the truth of what that means we are, on the truth of what Scripture teaches. And so meditation and mindfulness are very appropriate aspects of Christian discipline. If you sit somewhere and you get still before God and you pray or you listen or you just engage in stillness and silence, those are disciplines. Isaiah tells us in stillness and silence is salvation. And so there is a stillness and a silence that we as humans need, which that's just the modern psychological term for that is mindfulness. Being aware of yourself in the moment, being aware of the moment and being aware. Now, of course, that's abused. And it becomes a self-actualized, like, you need to find value in yourself, which, yeah, good luck with that. Especially if you're being mindful, you're going to be aware very quickly of how little confidence you should have in yourself. you get still and quiet, and all of a sudden the internal monologue is not a nice thing to listen to, right? And so, but being mindful of who we are in the creation that God has made and who God is, like, I think that's incredibly valuable for us as Christians. And it's a discipline we rarely practice anymore. So I think mindfulness can be super healthy, and it is a huge need in America for people to learn to rest and to be still and to be silent and to listen. Even when we pray, we often do it frenetically. We don't do a lot of listening. So, yeah, our minds and our body and all that kind of stuff, God made us to experience those: stillness, silence, rest. He hardwired that into us. That's probably some of the issues we face. So can it be abused? Is it abused? Yes. And in many ways, what it is secular psychology stealing something from Christianity and then, I guess it's this way, discovering something that they have just stolen from Christian disciplines. But stillness and silence is good for a human no matter what, which is part of how in Eastern religions they practice it too. They know it's good for them. It's a healthy thing because that's how God made us. Remember, all truth is God's truth. No matter who comes up with it, it's still true. It's the truth that God has caused to exist. But I really do feel like that's the healthy way for us as Christians to engage in them. We do have to ask ourselves, are we compromising? It is a healthy question we need to ask. Are we somehow making ourselves feel more comfortable with something that's in society? That's a fair question. Does it give a hint of sin? And even as Christians, we have to ask ourselves, will this cause someone else to have a real hard time with this? That always becomes, because of Christian community, we always say, well, could this cause a problem for somebody else unnecessarily? And if it's unnecessary, then it's something that we should always be willing to give up. To say, listen, I love my martial arts, but if in my friendship someone says, like, I just can't do that, I can't accept that you can do that, I may have to say, like, well, then for your sake, I won't do that. Or at least I won't talk about it around you, or I won't make a point of it, or whatever. We have to engage gently with one another about stuff like that. That's always a hard integration for us, isn't it? To figure out how do we speak the truth, knowing, though, that for some people, certain truth they're not prepared to deal with. That's always a challenge for us. But I think all of these type of things are in the psychological world. I mean, you can imagine how much I had to do this being trained as a psychologist to go, well, okay, that and that are good. The rest of that is trash. Or, man, I liked all this, but that was part of why I'm so glad I got to go to Southwestern at the time. Their program no longer does this. But at the time, Southwestern's program was very much so, you've got to know Freud as well as anybody else. No, any other psychologist knows Freud. The difference is we will then spend twice as much time on him, because once you know everything that you need to know about Freud, we then have to have additional study of, okay, now what of that can you keep and what of it do you toss, because it's not biblical. And we had to do that with everybody, with all the different theories. We had to learn it as well as the secular people had to learn it first. Then we had to evaluate it through the lens of Scripture. And I'm so grateful for that as a therapist now, but it was a lot of work then. But I think all things have to be handled that way. Thoughts or comments on that? Jason, I see a smile on your face back there. You got a comment to add? Okay, good. Yes, Andy.
Sometimes I'm thinking, Paul obviously dealt with this, because, obviously the early church was a minority.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It seems like he could have ate it.
And said clearly he could, right?
He's not going to eat it because he knows there's many weak people.
He was
associated too much with the ceremony.
That's right. So the idea of that the actual example that the Apostle Paul goes into in Romans 14, is that right? I think it's Romans 14. Anyway, that he goes into is the question of meat sacrificed to idols. And so that meat that had been sacrificed to an idol. So like if you go to one of the Greek cities from that era, Ephesus or Thessalonica or Philippi, where they had the markets, there was only one entrance, and the entrance went past the priests. And so what you would do is you would bring your wares past the priest to Athena or to Zeus or to Jupiter or whatever. And they would, the first thing they would do is they would take that, all your wares, and probably take a little bit as a gift to the priesthood. And then the rest of it would be made sacred by this god. And so then they would go into the market. Well, you can imagine, so Christians are walking around the Greek market and all of this food has been designated as sacred before Zeus or Athena or whoever. And so the Christian is going like, wait, do I eat this or not? And the Jews wouldn't, probably for the most part, they weren't, because that was not kosher. They could not eat that. And so they're like, well, we can't eat that. And so for the early Christians, many of whom were Jews or Greeks, and you're going, well, what do I do now? Do I eat that? I've eaten it all my life. I mean, what do I do with this? And Paul says, well, of course I can eat that. I'm free to eat that. But the problem is, what if the person who's with me is, for example, a Jew, a converted Jew who won't eat it, who can't eat it, what's funny is the way Paul says it is that I have enough faith to eat it. He lacks the faith to eat it. So I will not express the faith that I could express by eating it. I will choose not to. And so with this person, I'm not going to eat that meat. And he's calling Christians to, like in Philippians 2, to consider others more significant than yourselves. And so a great example is, so I host a poker game once a month at my house. And a lot of times, some of the people who come will have an alcoholic beverage, which is fine. They're all adults, and that's their decision between them and God. But at one point, there was a man who liked to come who was an alcoholic and said, I've been sober for, 17 years. Being around it is just really hard for me. And I said, then you just tell us when you're coming. And I will send an email out to all the men and say, no one bring alcohol tonight. That's an easy thing to not have, right? Well, we just won't do that. For his sake, because his company is worth more to us than whatever. So your company matters more to us. So if you want to come, you tell us, and I'll just send an email out and say, no one has any. It's not a hard decision to make. So in my mind, that's an example of living that out. It isn't that he thought we were wrong to have it. It's that it would have potentially caused him to stumble. He lacked the faith to be around it, so we didn't. And in my mind, that's the kind of thing that Paul is probably talking about is, listen, if this causes you to stumble, that we have meat on the table that was sacrificed to an idol, don't bother me. That idol is nothing. That idol is a piece of rock. You can sacrifice everything you want to it. It's a rock. It doesn't mean anything. But since that offends you, we're gonna not do that. And that's the challenge we often face in the church is, when do you challenge the Christian to a deeper faith? You need to be okay with this. Versus, but we will all try to back off on this for your sake. And that's why community's hard and requires the Holy Spirit, right? It requires us to be sacrificial. So, but that's a cool picture. Good question. Others? Yes, ma'am. Man, this is changing so fast. But my general principle, here's my whole answer. My whole answer is, I think somewhere between 11 and 14 is when a kid is mature enough to handle that. The world is not going to give you until 11 to 14. The world is not going to give you the option of doing the healthiest thing with your children. And if you wait till 11 to 14, they will already know about it before you get to them. And you want to be the voice in this. One of the things that all parents must do is initiate the conversation about sex and things like that. Whatever topic you want to have a voice in, you need to initiate that conversation. We now know, if you didn't know it before, that children take silence as significant. And so if you don't talk about it, they think there's a reason you're not talking about it. Now, some kids will come to you and ask, and you go like, well, I'll just wait. They'll ask when they're ready. Well, they might. But there's a really good chance they won't, and they're going to take the fact that you're not bringing it up as meaning this is a taboo subject. And so where we started, now again, you're talking Mark, who is now 19. So this information, I feel like, is potentially 10 years out of date. But the way we started, and I have this on my website too, how we talk to our kids about sex is, so here's the plan I did with Mark and we did with Ellie. And Holland is in the middle of it. Year one, age 9, is the spiritual aspects of sex, why God created sex. And with Mark, Ellie, and Holland, at the end of that conversation, ended with, "Now, would you like to know what sex actually is physically?" And Mark said, "Absolutely not." And Ellie said, "No, thank you." And Holland said, "Sure." And so, which he regretted. But so I think somewhere around there is when you need to begin communicating to your kids, "I'm ready to talk about this." And so with the first conversation we have, is there's no biology in it at all, except for that last part of the conversation, if they want to know it. But they also know, "I'm ready to tell you whenever you're ready. I will tell you about a year from now if you haven't brought it to me before then." And so that was both Mark and Ellie got to hear it a year later. And so the year one is the spiritual aspect of sex. What sex is intended to do, what the Bible teaches about the sex is intended to accomplish, the spiritual connection, the bonding, the gluing, all those different things that the Bible talks about sex. Year two is the biology of sex. And so we would go into the straight biology, the idea of procreation, the idea of the way this interacts, and the actual mechanics of sex, what sex is. Year three is the brokenness of sex. And that's where we talk about all aspects of sex that fall outside of God's creation, his design. And so that's when they find out what the timeout club is that we've been driving by all these years, and that all Mark knew for about 5 years was that it made his mom uncomfortable whenever he would reference it. And so he always did, even though he had no idea what it was. Interesting. So catch this, Holland, my 12-year-old, when we talked about this and I said, "What do you think the timeout club is?" He said, "That's a place where men dress up as women." Now, so he had no idea, but he had an idea. He knew this was something that happened, that there are men who dress up as women, and he assumed that because this was a place that was a bad place, that must be what happens there. And I don't know how many of his friends thought that. And so we explained, no, that's not what it is. This is what this is. Now, we talked about that too. And so that's when we talked about homosexuality. We talked about transgender issues, all those kind of things, and talked about how that as Christians we can be understanding and loving in the midst of those relationships without accepting either the sin or at least the brokenness, because in some cases it is clearly delineated as sin. In all cases, those are clearly delineated as brokenness, even if they're not sin, a broken aspect of sexuality outside of God's design about sex. And that's when we talk about premarital sex, and that's when we talk about pornography. And pornography usually actually makes the conversation earlier, because by 9... there's a real good chance that they've at least had the availability of it. I would tell you, this is a note to parents, if you have a 6-year-old in your house and your internet is not blocked or filtered, your child is going to see pornography. The men in the room know it comes to you. You don't have to seek it out anymore. It comes to you. My spam box is full of it, and one click would take me to it. And on the PS4 and on the Game Boys, and on the televisions that are online, I mean, you've seen, you'd go up into channels that are up a little high. All you have to do is have a kid type in the wrong channel, and they are now seeing at least a for sale for a pornographic thing that includes pictures. And so it is rampant, and it comes to you now. So in your family, it is important that if you have internet access, that there are barriers and blocks and that kind of stuff on. And I mean, nowadays, leapfrog devices usually have unrestricted internet access on them. And so you have to recognize, the pornographers, this is a multi-billion-dollar evil industry, and they are seeking out children. They're actively seeking. They know the earlier they can get them hooked, the longer they can keep them. And so it is as evil an industry as has ever existed. When I knew what we were up against, I was 5 when I saw my first pornography. And so that's hardwired for me. And so it is now something that's why, if I'm going to buy something on iTunes, Rebecca has to type in my password. I don't trust myself with unlimited internet access. I have blocks and filters and stuff like that. And so you need to have those things in your home, and filters and blocks and that kind of stuff. We've talked about that before. That includes, by the way, that includes grandparents. If you have grandkids coming over, you can't have unrestricted internet. You hand that little kid your iPad for them to play with. If you don't have anything that blocks that, if you haven't taken Safari off, if you haven't done any of that, one click and they're there. I mean, again, it comes to you now. But when I knew what I was dealing with as a young man in my 20s, when I think it was when the movie Pocahontas came out, would that have been after internet? Whichever one of the first Disney movies that came after internet, that the pornography industry, that the pornographers bought all the misspelled versions of the Disney website and put pornography on them, so that if a kid tried to type, this is before there were search engines very much, if a kid tried to type in whatever it was, Pocahontas.com or Mulan.com or whatever it was, that it would take, if they misspelled it, it would take them to a pornographic website. That's how evil an industry you're talking about. That when children's movies come out, they try to create a path via that. So it's pretty awful. But I usually tell them at 9 or earlier, hey, if you ever come across anything or you're shown anything, one, you need to know, you can come talk to me. I mean, I want my kids to know from early on, like, you can talk to me about it. You're not going to, there's not going to be an explosion. I'm not going to be weirded out. And so we have had, we had a kid in our neighborhood who thought pulling down people's pants was funny. And so they were walking around pulling down everybody's pants and pulling down their own pants. And like, my kids came straight to us and were like, hey, so you'll know so-and-so pulled down my pants. Like, they didn't have a sense of shame or fear of how we were going to respond to that. Like, okay, well, let's go talk to their mom and dad and we'll, you know, kids, that's a kid thing. But anyway, so I think where we have practiced it so far is we start at 9. That worked well with Holland too. I'm not sure with Michael how that's going to work. I mean, that's only 2 years from now with Michael, and I'm having a hard time imagining him handling that data. But we'll see with that. Good questions. You had a comment? Yeah.
Whenever I'm going to be talking about that with my kids, it's going to be vastly different than what it is now. So, you know, like with the whole Me Too movement and mm-hmm. MGTOW, you know, where do you see marriage going within the next?
Oh, gosh. Where do I see marriage going in the next few years? I'll give a few quick answers to that. My prediction when, way back when, I'm looking at Rebecca because I think she heard me one of the first times I said it. I started predicting an attack on, so that once I realized consensuality was going to be the only sexual ethic left, was consensuality, is that the secular was going to start attacking consensuality. And so the idea would be that, so there is no such thing as forbidden sex except non-consensual sex. Like that's where we are. If you don't realize that, that's where we are now. And so what already has happened is there are already laws and lobbies and people pushing to reduce the age of consent down into childhood. So that if a 12-year-old girl wants to have sex with a 40-year-old man, who are we to tell her she can't? Like that is under attack now. If a 14-year-old boy wants to have sex with his uncle, who's to tell him he can't? If he consents to it, why can't he? And so this will be a direction that this will be the next big thing. We're already dealing with the people wanting to marry themselves or marry a tree or marry a, I mean, those type of things are going to happen. So here's my opinion is, I actually believe that marriage was instituted by God. I don't think it was an evolved socio-ecological thing. I understand that that's part of the purpose that it serves for sure, is to offer a man a companion and a woman a protector. Like there's no doubt that that's part of what God was creating, which he says so in Genesis, right? At least the companion part. I think what we're going to face probably is that the church, here's another prediction since that's what you're asking for. I think we might already be there now if Trump hadn't been the president right now, is that we would be facing the pressure of if you won't sign every marriage license, then you don't sign any marriage license. I think we would have maybe been there by now or almost there by now if the Democrats had won this time around. I'm not making a political statement. I think that's what would have happened. I think in the future, all licensed ministers are going to have to make the decision as to whether or not they're going to represent the state in marriages anymore. Now, here's what's cool about that. And this is one of the things I love about the Adam and Eve account, no matter where you take it historically or not. The Adam and Eve account teaches us certain things about God's design and his intentionality. And one of the things that I love about it is this. There is no church in the garden. There is no Israel in the garden. There is no government in the garden. None of those things are required for marriage. None of those things are required for a wedding. They're not required. They're nice to have, but they're not required. I think that, so one of the ways I ask this question of other pastors now is, so if there was an adventure tour to Mars, or the first space people went to Mars, and they get there and all of them but one man and one woman die, can they get married? And I think the biblical account from the Adam and Eve would teach us that yes, they can. It is a covenant between a man and a woman to be faithful to each other and no one else until death. And the only necessary witness for that covenant is God. And God's on Mars. And so you would have a man and a woman could covenant to be faithful to each other until one of them died. And God was the witness of that. And they would be married. God doesn't need the church. God doesn't need Israel. God doesn't need governments to marry people. And so that is why frontiers people could get married. It's why the last survivors of a Mars expedition could get married. It's why Adam and Eve could be married. That being said, what happened along the way is the church, of course, said, yeah, this is something that we are believe in the institution of marriage. So we want to begin witnessing it. Now, at some point, the church kind of took it over and said, like, no, we decide who is married, which was a mistake, a power I don't think the church ever had. By the way, I'm having to do this quick. I thought I was going to have to make all kinds of theological decisions about this in months when I thought Hillary is going to win. I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to think about what do I believe about this? I've never had to wonder because being a good Christian and being a good American citizen overlapped. And now as it's not overlapping more and more, which by the way is normal, right? Most rarely have Christians, being a good Christian and being a good citizen rarely have gone together in human history. And that doesn't go together mostly on the planet right now. Does being a good Christian make you a good Iranian? Or a good Chinaman, Chinese, whatever the word is there. No, right? It does not. And there probably will come a time in America where you can be a good Christian or be a good American, but not both. That could easily happen. That would not be surprising. We've had the luxury of so far being able to do that. So what happened is the government came along and said, yes, Judeo-Christian ethics, not a Christian nation, but a nation founded on Judeo-Christian ethics. Yes, marriage, big deal. We're going to put all kinds of laws in place to protect it, and we're going to have all kinds of, and we're even going to recognize marriage as a government. This central government is going to recognize your little marriage because we believe in marriage that much. So we're going to license people to be the representative of the government at your wedding. And we're going to have them sign a piece of paper and send it in to us so we can charge you more taxes and pay a fee to get this done. That's which I think is what the government is really concerned about, is that fee and the tax thing. And so to say, we're going to recognize it and celebrate this with you because we believe in marriage too. And then at some point along the way, what happened was the government said, no, marriage is a right that we give. Marriage is a government right. We give you the right to be married. We give you the authority to be married. See, they confuse the fact that they passed a whole bunch of laws to protect marriage. They confuse that with thinking that it's a right they give. I'm teaching a government speech class to high schoolers right now. And one of the things I tell them is, here's the danger of accepting rights given to you by the government, is that they then take them back later. That's why the founders said that these rights did not come from the government. The founders were recognizing rights that were given by God, not the other way around. The government can't not give rights. So they can tell you you're allowed to do this, but then they can tell you you can't. That's a big part of the issue we're facing right now. So the government says, no, we're the one who decides who gets married. And we've decided marriage does not mean an adult man and an adult woman in a lifelong covenant before God. We've decided marriage means any two people actually who want to stay together right now, because now we have the first attack on this was not what you faced recently. It was no-fault divorce. That was the first attack on marriage in America, was no-fault divorce. So we now go, okay, well, we've now decided what marriage means. When the truth is, they were never involved in its creation in the first place. They don't get to define it. It's not theirs. So I think in the future, what we will see is more and more Christian marriages that are never recognized by the state. We will see what I will be asked to do is to come officiate a wedding as a representative of the church, but not a representative of the state. And they will never turn in a wedding license. And I had to wrestle through, was I willing to do that? And after prayer and contemplation and talking to a number of other pastors, I thought I was going to get so much pushback on this, guys. When I talked to other pastors, I'm like, I'm really thinking that there's absolutely nothing wrong with me marrying a couple and witnessing them as the church, witnessing their marriage as a church, and not being a representative of the state. And so far, 100% of the pastors I've gone to have said, like, yeah, I've kind of reached the same conclusion, which blew me away. I was expecting so much pushback on this. Like, here I was going to be some kind of rebel, and all these people going like, I think that's probably how it's going to have to be. And so, especially if the state comes along and says, unless you sign all of them, you can't sign any. I'd be like, well, then I don't represent the state anymore. But so can I still do a wedding? Well, I'm not the one making them married in the first. I'm just witnessing them wedding. They're the ones making themselves married. So I think there will come a time when us as pastors, what we do at a wedding is we witness the wedding I represent the church in witnessing your wedding and witnessing your marriage. By the way, I've now already done it twice. Yes, ma'am. And we need to wrap up. So last thing. I can't make that decision for them. If they're ready, if they want to be married under God, I would love to define that with them. But they need to make a covenant with one another to be faithful to each other until death parts them. Huh? There's no way around it. If that's what marriage is, that's what it is. Now, there's no reason why you wouldn't have the church witness your wedding. There may be a reason in the future why you wouldn't have the state witness your wedding. There's been numerous of those, and a lot of people who don't get married for IRS reasons. And so like, well, the church could still witness your wedding, even though the city does.
We're going to live together is not the same thing. No,
I'm covenanting to. Yeah. So couples
with you is not because I handed something into the government.
Right.
That's my covenant with you. And that's completely separate from someone saying,
but, and notice signing a license with the government does not keep you married.
Uh-huh. And then, you know, Bob and I have the code card, and then they're like, well, we're married under God. That's
yeah.
What
Chris says. No. Like, so don't misquote me, and don't let them misquote me. That's not what I said. Do I see how someone could take what I just said and abuse it? Sure. Satan abused Scripture. That's totally different. And so we can jump back into this, but to define something accurately and the fact that some people may pervert that, we can't solve that. We're 7 minutes over, so we have to be done. Done. We can talk more about it.